Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today I'm proud to bring you the Satori Dialogues with Serpentis Satori. Our topic of discussion is the new gods. Greetings and welcome, Satori. How are you today?
All right.
I'm glad to hear that. Now, Tolkien once said that he was trying to bring forth a new mythology through his Lord of the Rings and related works, and he did, and that inspired the entire role-playing game industry to come into being and to continue along those lines for very many years. And Jack Kirby tried to create a new pantheon at Marvel, at DC, and through several independent comic book companies. And his creations, his divine creations, have been made into big-budget movies. The Eternals over at Marvel and the New Gods were in the Snyderverse at DC. So creating gods and emerging gods is indeed something very possible and something very powerful.
Yeah, and it's also something that in some ways George R. R. Martin wrote his books in response to Tolkien.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting both the level of interesting religious stuff in Game of Thrones, which is a separate topic altogether, and the level of relatability all of the main characters in Game of Thrones have.
I can see that.
And as a result of that, Game of Thrones was the biggest thing in a long time. And that meant everybody had a team and t-shirt for their clan in Game of Thrones and all of that when it completely took over society 10 years ago.
Yes, I remember people identified with the Starks or with the Lannisters or with several of the other houses that were prominently featured and rooted, as you said, for their team as the saga unfolded. There were the readers of the book who knew the sacred version, and then there were the followers of the television show, which was the sacred version in its own right, although the others considered it a bastardized and inferior version. I remember all that going on. It unleashed a wave of creativity on YouTube and other media with people making songs and skits and parodies of it. And it was, I believe, the number one top show on the planet for a while.
On the planet for its last three seasons, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, out of that, if you already have a team t-shirt, you're going to have an action figure or whatever for your team. And if you buy stuff for your team every once in a while, like it's a soccer team, you eventually end up having lots of Game of Thrones stuff.
Right.
And at the time, it seemed like Daenerys was the most popular character, because toward the end of Game of Thrones, we had politicians talking about her. We had musicians talking about her. We had, toward the end, when everybody thought she was going to be queen, she took over our culture for a couple months.
Now, do you like the way they wrapped up her arc?
No.
Do you agree the way they wrapped up her
arc? No.
Yeah, most people don't.
Because she really is the breaker of chains, and because she's trying to break the wheel, she should have won, because she was actually going to bring change to Westeros, which is why I ultimately think they undid her in those last couple episodes.
Can you explain that a bit?
Because they didn't want to deal with the kind. Well, she talks about how all of the clans are spokes in a wheel.
Right.
And she doesn't want to change the wheel. She wants to break the wheel. She wants to change how government works because she frees slaves and has dragons and has all of these things going for her because she's woke. She's trying to correct all of the inherent injustices within the feudal system of Westeros. And that's too much, so they turn her into a fascist in the last 20 seconds.
Well, they foreshadowed it because she wanted from the beginning to just go to where the king's landing and wipe the Lannisters off the planet and not avoid a long bloody war with lots of people dying. But her advisors, their advice, although humane, turned out to have been like the worst possible thing that she could have done. And she followed it time and time again to her loss.
Yes. But I think that's what that was about, that they just couldn't handle her breaking the wheel.
I believe that if they'd stretched it out another like 3 seasons, maybe they could have fleshed everything out a lot better and done a better job with how they wrapped it up. The last 3 seasons, even though they were the most popular, if you were following from the beginning, I only read the first book and the half of the second book, so I didn't really get into the books that much. The writing declined rapidly after they ran out of material from Martin directly.
After they were off book, yeah.
And although I appreciate all the work that went into them, because I watched the making of or the commentary programs that they had attached to it and watched all the extras on the DVD, this was a labor of love from everybody. So I appreciate all the work that went into it. But they changed the Tyrion and Varys, way too much. And then they rushed everything where it felt rushed, which wasn't the fault of the people working creatively, actualizing the script. But for those who were there from the beginning, it felt kind of rushed and like they were teleporting around from place to place rather than taking the time it would have taken to get there. And then all the things that happened in between, they kind of brushed over them. They left out some very important characters, I understand.
Well, considering one of the books is basically about Tyrion trying to get to Dany. There's a whole thing that goes on in one of the later books that is Tyrion arriving on the island with the Free Cities, but Dany's not in Meereen anymore. So he has to go where she is, and so then he has to do his like weird midget acting thing. And one of his characters in midget acting is actually Hercules in the book. That's how we know they had Hercules in their world.
Okay. He was called Hercules?
He's called Hercules. Because there's the whole thing about Hercules and the lion in that book.
If you let me know which of the books it was, I'll dig that book out.
It's not the last one. It's the one before it.
Okay.
It's not the one that got cut into 2 different books. It's the one before that one.
I will seek it out.
But because I had wondered that out loud when they were talking about the name of Arya's wolf is a name that I assumed was that world's Medea, because we're just told she's a dragon witch from the myths. Like, okay, so Arya essentially names her wolf Medea? That's intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find out that one of Tyrion's characters in his midget acting thing is Hercules as a midget. Because there's a thing where he's taking off his costume at the beginning of a chapter. I'm like, okay, so they have Medea and Hercules and Theseus. That's interesting.
That is an interesting combination. especially since...
Because they obviously don't have a Battle of Troy in that world, but they have some of the Greek heroes. Well, we do have dragons in.
Interesting, what? Too. The relationship with each other is interesting also.
Yeah. But that flew by, and if you didn't read the books, you didn't pick up on that. And they completely edited out the midget wrestling thing from the TV show anyway, and he does that for like a year. But that's where the Hercules reference is hidden in Game of Thrones, is that it's one of Tyrion's characters.
Okay, awesome.
He's a midget wrestler.
Well, Hercules had a midget version in Bes, the Egyptian divinity. That was often associated with Hercules, and Hercules was also a favorite subject of the satyr plays. So he did have that aspect to him, you know, the buffoonish Hercules, the clownish Hercules. That was a part of the mythos. It was a shadowy part, but it was a part even in Greco-Egyptian times.
It's just interesting that pool that then connects Tyrion to Hercules, and Tyrion's motto is "I drink and I know things." Because that was the T-shirt I had in the day.
Now, you also picked another god to talk about, Harry Potter. And right now, Harry Potter's author...
Well, first, let's talk about gods old and new. If you actually get a very short summary of Daenerys' biography, because originally, in the second book, when I had this conversation with one of my Hecate friends, she and I talk about it, and I'm like, well, Daenerys is... all the things we don't talk about Medea. But then when we get toward the end of the story, when she's the breaker of chains and the breaker of the wheel, and we keep in mind how much of her story is about her dead ex-husband, and when I actually start seeing altars of hers with her own candle holders, I realize she's essentially being treated as Isis. Well, Khaleesi and Set almost mean the same thing, though. They both mean female chieftain. And they both have important dead ex-husbands. And weird magical superpowers. And are the goddess of correct wokeness and correcting injustice.
That's a very insightful way of looking at Daenerys.
Well, that's my lead into, and why is she sitting next to Harry? Well, the obvious explanation is she and Harry can both speak dragon language. They're the only people in both of their worlds who can talk to dragons. They both speak that language.
Now, in our world, speaking with dragons, which is one of the things that Hermes did to get the start of the Hermetic literature flowing and bring wisdom to our world, was a good thing. Whereas in the ancient Near East, a little further beyond Greece and Egypt, it was a bad thing to be talking to serpents. And we have a cautionary tale in the book of Genesis of what comes from talking to serpents and believing what they say. So
Christians believe that. Only Christians believe that. The Jews actually take what the serpent says at face value. Know ye are gods. The serpent didn't lie. God lied. Christians do that because Christians had to invent original sin. And to make up original sin, the serpent had to be lying, because we cannot be gods. There is only Jesus. Jews do not take what the serpent said as a lie. That's a later Christian interpretation that comes from having to invent original sin. because there's no actually original sin in the Bible, even in the New Testament. It's a made up thing later.
Yeah, all the ancient texts, like for instance with the Greek mythology, they passed through the lens of, or passed through the liquid and got colored by the Victorians. So a lot of the myths as we know them through our culture are Greek mythology filtered through the Victorians, which added a whole other layer of things to the original material that weren't there initially.
Well, it happens with folklore too. That's the whole thing about the Brothers Grimm versus the real story. The much darker versions of Cinderella and Snow White before Disney.
One of the things that I do when I perform my observance of the labors is I read everything I can in a particular labor, including children's mm-hmm. books. And that's a trippy type of experience because they don't want to mention certain of the darker parts of the labors and the associated events that accompanied them. So they'll make up stuff, you know, to make sense of the story that they're telling. And the stuff they make up is really wild, but sometimes phenomenally insightful.
I did that recently with my Indian coworkers because I was trying to explain. Because for all the gods they have in India, India does not have Persephone, Hecate, or Athena. They have 1,000 gods, but not those three.
Why did you say that?
Because I think those three are carryovers from Minoan civilization.
Okay.
Which is why they have reflections in the, which is why we have Hecate in the Mediterranean, but there's no Irish Hecate. Hecate only gets to Ireland when the Romans take her there. The Morrigan is not Hecate at all. At all. But for all the gods the Indians have, because their religion, for the most part, has had the same main characters for the better part of 10,000 years, Athena would look like a new god to a Hindu. Persephone would be a new god to a Hindu. So I had to explain the Persephone story to my Indian coworker as the god of banking kidnaps the goddess of flowers.
Okay.
Which isn't a lie.
That's very interesting.
But their death god isn't Hades either. So explaining Hades to a Hindu is complicated too. Like, no, my death god is really the god of money. Hades is really the god of money, who is also...
names, which means riches or wealth.
Right. Plutocracy. All the words that use his name mean money. Like plutocracy. Plutocrat.
Right.
All of those words mean money. He's the god of banks. And shortly after I tell that story, we have Silicon Valley Bank blow itself up.
Yes, reality often has magical conversations. I've noticed that over the years. Very powerfully.
But to a Hindu, Hecate is a new god because they don't have Hecate. Because to explain Hecate to a Hindu, she's Lakshmi and Durga at the same time? No, that can't be right. That's crazy talk. That's crazy.
Well, you brought up an interesting point, though, with that statement, because even in the ancient Near East and the Mediterranean area, you had composite gods, you know, gods that were part Aphrodite, part Athena, or other combinations.
Zagros. Zagros most famously.
So you do have that going on. And in the story of the tale of Typhon, you have the gods fleeing Olympus to avoid the invasion. and winding up in Egypt wearing animal masks, and then you're given a list of which Egyptian god is actually a Greek god in disguise. And the Greeks and the Romans and other Mediterranean people used interpretatio, where they kind of told you which god is which god under which cultural guise, you know, for each culture they visited. And you had a lot of diffusion happening at those times as the tales got exchanged and gods found themselves in new cultural guises or thinly disguised guises in different cultures in the area.
And that brings us right back to Daenerys. Because when my friend who sent me the first two books when I moved to Chicago wasn't really asking my opinion about the clans and the political intrigue, she was more interested in talking to me about the religions in Game of Thrones, which is a separate topic, but that's how she pulls me in, because she's trying to talk to me about the sept versus the old faith. Because in the first book, we think there are only two religions. We don't have the other religions explained to us till a little bit later.
Right, the seven, and then the old gods.
Yeah, the old faith. The religion of the south and the religion of the north.
And then you had the fire god, who for a while there was speculation that he was one of the seven, the fire god.
He probably is, in the same way the god of the assassins is the stranger, because the stranger is the death god in the sept. In the same way, the fire god of the red cult probably is the forger, the sept version of Vulcan and Ogun.
I'm sure people who read the book that are mystically inclined have tried or have succeeded in attuning with these fictive representations of ancient patterns. I know that happened in Star Trek with the different...
Witches who work with trees can do everything Bran can do. A lot of my witch friends can do those things. Because that's Celtic religion before the Druids.
Have they used the Game of Thrones to supplement, explain?
They
used
Game of Thrones to explain.
Okay.
Because at one point one of my roommates asked that, and I'm like, no, she can do, I assume, everything Bran can do. I'm like, well, what about you in Game of Thrones? Like, that character was cut from the TV show. There actually is a character called the Alchemist.
Yeah, I noticed when I was a kid that the barbarians, you know, of the fictive barbarians of sword and sorcery or heroic fantasy, they were very much an exploration of what would happen if Hercules made the other choice when he was given the choice of the crossroads.
Yeah.
And all the literature.
Tell the baby version of that story for our audience. Tell the version of the crossroads in the same way I told you the fortune cookie Persephone story.
Well, basically, at one point, some say early on in his career, Hercules came to a crossroad, and there were two women there, Areti, which people usually translate as virtue, and Kakia, which people usually translate as vice. Their names mean different things, though. Areti means personal excellence more than it means virtue, and Kakia means more ill intent than it does vice. But anyway...
So it's good and evil. To choose between good and evil.
Good and evil. So evil tells Hercules he's the son of a god already, so he shouldn't have to do anything, and he can actually, by using his divine gifts, live a really easy life and have people serve him, and you know, all he'd have to do is use his might and exploit people. And Areti, or good, tells him that, yeah, he can do that, but it would be better if he used his might, which was his divine gift, to help people. and to be a positive force in the world, and, you know, to protect those that needed protection and to guide those who needed guidance, and so on and so forth. So Hercules chose virtue, even though the road would have been much harder. It was the thin is the road and narrow is the gate type of thing from the Bible. But he chose that because it promised immortality, whereas the other way, the immortality it promised was notoriety. So that's essentially the story. So also you could look at it as a service to self being the evil and service to others being the good. And in the entire barbarian literature of sword and sorcery, the barbarian is pretty self-serving. He's still an instrument of gods and divine guidance and all sorts of things like that, but he pretty much wants to drink and have as much sex as possible and so forth. So even though his road is still fraught
with... To be Tyrion.
Yes, I had thought of that, but yes. So the barbarian literature explores what would happen if Hercules chose the path of self-service more than the path of service to others. And it, even though that's not stated, if you're a student of Greek mythology, it's right there. And it answers every question through the fictive adventures of the barbarians as to why it's better to choose service to others. And a lot of them wind up becoming wise kings, where that's the logical conclusion of taking that path. It might take you off the path for a little while, but even if you choose the darkness, you're still on the same path, and it'll all turn out if you leave yourself open to learning from your experiences. So that's a bridge version.
Right, and that's the tie-in with Tyrion.
Yes, it is.
Because Tyrion really is the alcoholic whoremonger. That's quite true about Tyrion.
And that's what was promised by Gaia. And I guess we can follow Tyrion's journey and see how he did with it. Well,
but before he finds Daenerys, he has to be Hercules, so someone has to have told him that story before he ends up serving Daenerys.
Or he spontaneously lives that story, because that's what happens in real life. We wind up, until we wake up to the fact that we're living stories, we live stories unconsciously. And they're old stories. They've been around for quite a while. And that's why we identify with certain songs and certain bands of literature, and especially fiction or biography, and because we recognize...
And on that note, Mr. Potter.
Okay.
Because I, like Mr. Potter, had my parents die when I was a child and was raised among very normal people in Ohio. And eventually moved to New Orleans and played with the very powerful kids. But Harry also, the whole point at the beginning of his final book is he's very weird for a wizard because he's just and kind. Because that's what the goblin tells him in the last book. Right around the time he realizes he's going to have to die.
And oddly enough, James Gunn said that with Superman, they're returning to a kind and just Superman. So Superman 2 is the incarnation of Hercules in our modern pop culture.
Well, that's a topic we might want to spin off into a separate conversation, because that's the conversation about Superman and Captain America as as the conservative hero, because those are both right-wing heroes who everybody can get behind. I mean, the only Marvel t-shirt I have right now is a Captain America shield, he's my hero in the original Avengers, because Tony Stark's a jerk.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, Tony Stark's a jerk, and the whole argument between Tony and Steve in Civil Wars, all of my friends side with Steve. But what if they tell us not to go someplace we need to go?
Uh-huh.
But again, that's just versus unjust. The easy life guy versus Captain America.
Yeah, very true. These stories are alive, and they play a bigger role in our lives than most people give them credit for. Most people look at them as entertainment, but what brings you to that particular entertainment? What brings you back? What has you coming back time and time again? Why do you live the same story over and over and over again until you catch it and you decide to recast your life in a different way?
And because Harry Potter is cooler than Jesus. No, but he's also Death and Resurrection, and he's also an orphan, and there's enough of his biography that sounds like what most people think Jesus' biography is. That using him as the new Jesus makes sense, but he makes more sense as the guy before Jesus, as Osiris.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's a wizard, because we don't know a lot about his father, because he rides dragons and causes a revolution. That sounds more like Osiris to me. That sounds more...
Yeah, that does sound like Osiris.
Yeah. And so obviously there are some people out there who realize that Harry and Danny both speak dragon languages and are woke. So obviously they're a couple.
Uh-huh.
Because they can flirt with each other in dragon language, and Harry can ride Daenerys' dragons and teach Danny magic. And since they both start revolutions and they're both trying to break the wheel, Harry says something equivalent to breaking the wheel in the last book, too.
Hmm.
So on some level, they're just new forms of Isis and Osiris. And the people that are treating them as new gods don't know their Egyptian mythology and haven't made the connections my friends and I made this. I'm like, no, but it's all right there. you don't even need the long version of Isis's bio to realize how much she's Danny. You can do it from Wikipedia.
Now, some people do notice these things and write about them, but most people dismiss them as coincidental, or again, because you're telling a story, it's trope.
Well, that's what archetype means, right?
Right.
Right. It means that archetype is always with humanity, because as a prototype, as a kind of person. Well, back to the last conversation about namaste. Because as a type, they're always with us. So as an archetype, they're always with us. So when we make that heroic, we realize there are some people that do act like that person.
Hmm. I found that basically my belief is that we're here to not live the stories of the gods, but change the stories in the gods, because the gods are stuck in these
break the wheel.
Stories. What happened?
Break the wheel.
And I was talking about that on the Theurgy show the other day, that I believe that we're the gods here, that we're dreams of the gods, if you want to look at it that way. And we're stuck in these stories, and we can live these stories out unconsciously and still serve the divine, because it's mulling through these issues. You know, it's trying to resolve something. Or if we become awake, we can start looking for different ways of ending the story or having the story go. And that plays out in our popular culture, in our popular imagination, and in our lives if we do that consciously. So when I lived the barbarian thing, and it was for very many years, it was, again, to resolve, you know, these questions, to resolve these issues with descending into the darkness, you know, the trip to the underworld, if you will. And I learned a lot from it. I found that once I'd resolved that in myself, the stories were no longer as appealing to me. The stories no longer held my attention as much as they did before. I still enjoy them. You know, I enjoy all aspects of the Herculean legend, and I find myself exploring it in literature as well as through my actions and my deeds. But I find that if I get what it was supposed to show me or teach me, I don't need to go revisit it as much.
Right, like the other Crossroads story about Paris,
mm-hmm.
where he is offered the choice of Aphrodite, who offers him the most beautiful woman in the world, Hera, who offers him to be the greatest king ever, and he chooses Aphrodite.
Yes, he does.
And leads to the and creates the Trojan War.
That divides the time of
by making that choice.
Time of legend and forebodes the beginning of history when the gods are no
right.
longer as alive as they were before. So how are you exploring, or how are you living, or how are you tapping into these myths? Like how do they play themselves out?
In the same way you did, in the same way you did the barbarian thing. When I took this magical name, there was a character with almost the same name in a Clive Barker book, and he also comes back to break the wheel. Because the ghosts aren't going to heaven, they're just going around and around. So he has to fix that, because his quest begins because a ghost sends him on a quest. So when I was trapped in that story, that was the story. And I was in the underworld because I was trying to make sure the ghosts moved on.
I've been there too, so I recognize the state of mind or the places you described.
But at this point, I, like you, don't have to save the world anymore, so this is retiring to coaching.
Be one of Athena's mentors, huh?
Yeah. But also, because of the kind of wizard I am, I'm a doctor-style practitioner, so just handing out Florida water and road opener makes the world a better place.
Now, one of the publishers that I work with had a suggestion that I'd like to pursue in a podcast, and I'll talk to you about that offline, but it ties into what you just described. We have several other major sages and seers that now have their voice on Mount Olympus, who are also, as you call it, cookbook type of magicians. And one of them has written over 65, she's authored or co-authored 65 books on cookbook magic. So I want to start getting people who practice that together and having like a forum like we often have, or a panel like we often have on the show, because that intrigues me. My magical practice is something very different. It's very akin to what Americans call New Thought, which is something that
Yeah, you don't use tools.
Right. use your imagination.
And because you don't use tools, it all looks like ceremonial magic to you.
Right.
Because it all is.
Very well put.
No, because it is. Because there is the level of magic that is theater.
Well, Brandy Williams, she's pointed out that, like, the low magic, if you want to call it that, is called thaumaturgia, which in Greek means creating miracles. So it's not considered low magic by the Greeks. And then theurgia, which is more the divine, you know, hooking up with the divine patterns and anchoring them here, or high magic or ceremonial magic or divine magic, or pick your title. But the implication is that there's a higher magic and there's a lower magic. From where I stand, it's all magic. You know, there isn't higher or lower. There are a bunch of things that you do.
Well, that goes back to the definition of witchcraft as practical folklore.
Mm-hmm.
That practical magic, low magic, witchcraft, is practical folklore.
Right. It's folkloric.
And ceremonial magic involves a little, well, ceremonial magic is bringing a god into it. Ceremonial magic on some level is putting on a little play for a god. Even if that play is just a mass, you're still putting on a play for a god.
Because of the way that I've developed, I've participated in several ceremonies over the course of my life, and I've created a few. I used to write mythical plays starting in high school, or even earlier, actually. In grammar school, I remember I wrote a couple of mythical plays with a point to them, you know, at the end. And I don't know why I discontinued that activity. There's a lot of things we do in life. Like, I used to draw a lot when I was a young kid, and I stopped doing that altogether, even though I was quite good at it and I enjoyed it. I guess putting on plays was something that I left after my television show, which was all, you know, pretty much social commentary and empowering statements through theater. I haven't really done any, like, I was Samson in a play in NIAC for a while, but I haven't really done any theater since, on a grand scale, since the TV show. So maybe I'll look into ceremonial magic some more and play with it.
Well, I mean, that's the use of the tools, because the tools allow you to externalize your mind energy into a dagger, externalize your heart energy into a cup, and deal with what you deal with when you break a wand.
Okay.
And deal with how much fun it is in your life when you break a wand. Going back to Harry Potter and stuff in there that's true. Well, you know, when I break a wand, I call you and specifically tell you I'm without a wand for a week, so things are going to be a little bit off.
With Conan and with Hercules, the weapon is disposable. Hercules just cuts a new club of olive wood, and he can actually plant his clubs so they become olive trees, which again is a lot of material to meditate on for quite a while, given that Athena is the god who gave olives to humanity. And Conan, in the movies and the television show, he's given an Atlantean sword, which is in the stories. But in the stories, the Atlantean sword is useful for, like, one adventure, and then that's it. The Atlantean sword disappears, and he picks whatever weapon he can use, whatever's at hand, to accomplish what he wants to accomplish. So the tools don't have as much of a power. There are emblems, like the lion skin cloak and the bow and the
because you're not as invested in them, because at the end of first level in most magic traditions, you make your tools for the first time. And so if you do that at the end of your first year of magic, by the time you're in your 10th year or your 20th year of magic, when you break a wand, it messes your life up for a little while.
I can understand that, because I've had things that attain significance and energy over time, and something happening to that thing cause a disruption in my life. So I can understand that as well. Also, entities are, getting back to Daenerys and Harry Potter, entities can be created, like egregores and tulpas. Literature, there are literary characters like Sherlock Holmes, like Tarzan, like Conan, that have taken on a reality of their own and outlived their creators.
But see, I would say those are archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
Because all of those are old gods under new names.
Robert E. Howard, in fact, was threatened by Conan when he first encountered him. Conan made him, Robert E. Howard had run into a writer's block or an uncreative streak, and Conan appeared to him full-blown as a character and dictated his first adventure. Robert E. Howard had to, jot it down. And Conan became his most... a powerful and successful creation, and is still around to this day. Comic books, movies, toys.
In the same way, Holmes and Moriarty did both die when they fall on Reichenbach Falls, but he has to bring Sherlock back.
Right.
That's not the last book. He tries to kill Sherlock off, and he can't.
Right. So Daenerys and Harry Potter, too, people have heard those names throughout the planet. People know who they are. They're not an obscure version of the gods of modern times. They've taken on a divinity of their own, as you're so clearly pointing out.
They're two of the most popular characters in the past 20 years. And until I sat down and thought about why would they be on an altar together, and I'm like, wait, it's obvious. They can talk dirty to each other in dragon. They can talk.
And realizing that you're living the story and that you resonate with the character because the character represents you, that is something that people deal with in different ways. Everything from, that's interesting, or, oh, my God, I never saw this before. How did you first react when you realized that some of the characters that you resonated with or you liked represented a lot more than just an escapist experience like most people class them?
Well, there are things that are said about that character in the Clive Barker book that very obviously apply to myself. So when I was given my copy of that book to be my very first copy of that book, it was very clear that because the character who's the hero of that book is a son of a god, but he's making his living as a forger. He forges paintings in the beginning of the book.
Is this a magicka?
And yes, this is a magicka.
Okay. I read that once long time ago. I have to reread it.
Because in New Orleans, because no one in my circle, because Harry Potter hasn't quite happened yet. I don't know who Harry Potter is till the millennium, because obviously I don't get to meet Harry Potter till he goes into the labyrinth. In the book where he goes in the labyrinth, then I find out who he is. I don't know who he is till Goblet of Fire comes out. But in my first year of New Orleans, my witch friend and I joke that we escaped from a Clive Barker novel. Of course we have this attitude. We escaped from a Clive Barker novel. But, I mean, that whole Clive Barker novel is about your evil twin and fascism and gods doing crazy stuff. That's what that book is about. Because the villain in that book is also a fascist tyrant.
In Star Wars, too, the original trilogy, we had that play itself out. At the time, not realizing that it was a prophecy and a warning for us here in this country.
Yeah.
People
but that's a topic for another conversation when I rewatch it. After I rewatch Andor and when this season of Bad Batch is over, then we can think about doing the Star Wars Antifa episode.
Yeah, I remember when people who were people who were living the tale of the Empire realizing that they're the bad guys. And I remember there was a lot of in Star Wars, and there was a lot written at the time with that realization. And it was very interesting, but a burst of understanding or a burst of light came forth in people's minds. And it was really illuminating to read the reaction to it.
Yeah. Because Harry and Danny are anti-fascist until they mess up Danny's character and make her fascist.
Yeah, that seemed kind of random, as if it came from left the field.
It seems very strange for someone who thinks their destiny is to break the wheel. That seems very odd.
The only sense I can make of it was that her trying to break the wheel in the past led to tragedy. So it was a comment on liberators, how liberators often become tyrants. And it foreshadowed it too,
right,
with the fact that the madness ran in her family. And how do they know she's not, going to go mad?
Yeah, the thing about flipping a coin. The thing about with Targaryens, you flip a coin.
One of the things that Athena and I talk about often is the whole hair color thing that plays such a significant role in the new series and the old series, and starts the whole suspicion into the king's family and the king's children, the Baratheon line. They ignored with Jon Snow. He doesn't have white hair.
Right.
But he's a Targaryen.
Right.
Whose father was the Targaryen.
He's the product of the rape that starts the Civil War.
But it wasn't a rape, according to at least the television show. It might have been an...
According to the memory, it isn't, but keep in mind in the first couple books, we are explained that that's the reason for Robert's rebellion.
Right. No,
that
I know that
him being conceived leads to Robert's rebellion.
All right. Again, we don't have that much time, so we'll go into it offline, I guess. But so this is a lot of really interesting stuff is coming out through our conversation, and it really needs to be looked at by anybody who's interested in such things or involved with magic and or a fan of pop culture icons, realizing that it's a whole other dimension to these stories that are in our comic books and our movies and on our television shows than they might suspect. But what thoughts do you want to leave with the people based on the material we covered today?
Well, keep in mind, I think deities are both aspirational, and I also do believe in the namaste thing, that we are all reflections of a god.
Mm-hmm.
So if gods are aspirational, they're trying to tell you how you should grow, and your personal hero is Captain America or Harry Potter or Daenerys Targaryen, you could do more for society. Society needs you. You need to vote. you need to run for school board. You need to do something. Harry Potter wants you to do something.
So does Hercules. Hercules, to take your talents, whatever they are, and to dedicate them in service to your community.
Right. If we want the world to change, we have to be the change.
Right.
Because that's the point of magic. The point of magic is be the change.
Yes, once you get
I come from wizards that always want to lead by example.
Right.
In my spiritual family, you lead by example.
In my mythical family, it's the same. And it's the alternative to living the social script. You know, society has a script. Each society has a script that defines the reality of that society. And many people wonder if there's more. This is the more. These are scripts beyond that feed and inform the society, but they're beyond the social constructs that we live in.
Yeah. Go into the darkness and see what and see what you have left when you come out. Achtung, baby, Achtung.
Yeah, that darkness is rearing its head again in our culture. And there was, I believe, at a drag queen story time, some of the protesters.
A bunch of neo-Nazis showed up. Yeah.
Yeah, and they were chanting Sieg Heil and Achtung and all sorts of things. And again, would you have thought as a kid that this would pop up again ever?
Yes, because it's a cycle.
You're wiser.
Although I never would have thought Jamie Lee Curtis would be Best Supporting Actress or Donald Trump would be president. If I went back in time and talked to my 16-year-old self about that, I would probably not believe me.
Yeah, I wouldn't believe me either.
I probably would not believe even me.
Now, how can people reach you? Are you still through me if they want to?
I'm still. They should still reach me through you, because I'm working with you now, and because I'm not trying to do. I'm trying to be more involved in the lower level of my reality, but since we have a mayoral election in Chicago this week, I have to pay attention to that and see how that plays out. But this mayoral election very much is going to be old versus young, north versus south. This mayoral election is incredibly important for America, which is why I'm still in Chicago.
may all turn out to the best for all concerned. Thank you for being there and channeling energies toward that. And I will talk to you very soon, my friend.
All right. Bye.
Bye. And thanks to everybody who tuned in, whether you called in, whether you clicked on a link, or whether you'll check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Take care, everyone.